Is interviewing Jesse Melas. Jesse lives at 1400 Old Canton Lane, East Lansing, Michigan, 48823. Her telephone number is 3326930, and the area code is 517. Jesse is being interviewed for the Lansing unit of the Women's Overseas Service League. Jesse, when did you go overseas?
In August of 1950.
1950, and where did you go?
My first assignment was Munich, Germany.
Munich, Germany? How long were you overseas?
3 years.
Oh, three.
And stayed the entire time in Munich.
What prompted you to go overseas?
Well, during the war period, I tried to join the waves and didn't pass the eye test. And so I sort of forgot about it. And then when it was announced that they were recruiting teachers, I sort of got interested and then sort of forgot about it. And then when it happened again, I decided to apply. And several reasons. One was I was sort of interested in going to Europe. And I was also interested in seeing what had happened during the war. And I have had and had relatives in Holland. And so I was curious to see them and see how they fared, because it had been very bad from our reports during the war.
How close were these relatives in Holland? Were they cousins or...?
They were aunts and uncles and cousins. They were my father's family. He was the only one who was in the United States. The others had gone into the Asiatic area or had remained in Holland.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me a little bit about your experiences.
Well, I guess the first thing that impressed me or struck me was very much as it had everybody else at that time, some of the results of the devastation that had happened during the war period. And some of the streets were still blocked off. Some of the buildings you could see that had been cleared, but where other buildings had been attached to the colors of, you could tell, a different room on the side of the building. The railroad station in Munich was still, with the glass-covered areas were still in sort of bad shape. But things have been cleaned up considerably. And so I think that was probably the first realization how bad, how much damage a bomb could do. And then among other things, as you'd meet some people, you got impressions. One of my first impressions was at the Oktoberfest we'd gone, and the mobs of people, and finally a group of German people in one of the beer tents signaled and joined us, and we spent the evening with them, and we spoke some English. Our German was nil, and we got along very well. And after the closing, we went to one of the nightclubs, and so we found out then that they and some of the people in the restaurant, the violin player and some of the other members of the band, were refugees from Marienbad, Germans, from Czechoslovakia.
Refugees from Czechoslovakia in Germany?
They were Germans. They had been a group of Germans that had settled in the area, and when the war came along, after the war, they were thrown out of Czechoslovakia.
Oh.
See, because all of these boundary changes over the different years, one thing or another. So we met them, and we met them a few times afterwards. We went ahead, didn't really strike up a strong friendship or anything, but we saw them several times afterwards.
Now, am I correct here? They were Germans that had gone to Czechoslovakia, lived in Czechoslovakia until roughly 1940...
Well, to the war period.
During the war period.
And then after the war,
they were sent back to Germany.
They were thrown out,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that was one of the things that was a good fun. And, of course, it was 1950 was the Oberammergau play, and we had tickets for the last play of the season.
Jessa, before you go on with this Oberammergau play, do you remember that great big bear in the Oktoberfest? Or wasn't he there in 1950?
I don't remember now.
Oh, in 1951 or 52, they had a bear, I would say, that was about 60, 70 feet tall. And he hollered, "Leven Brau." His mouth would open.
Oh, yeah. Now, yeah, over the tent.
Yes, near the
tent. Yeah, uh-huh.
And do you remember the horses?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I don't remember that much about them, but I remember.
Weren't there about
the bear wagon?
10 teams of horses?
Well, on the teams, yeah.
Right.
So, very much like the, what is it, Budweiser's team here?
Right, but weren't there about 10 horses pulling those kegs of beer?
Uh-huh. Well,
it was a real carnival spirit.
Yes, well, it was. It had rides, and you could, you know, do things, and of course the chicken, the specialized chicken, the broiled chicken kind of thing, and the spits. And lots of beer. Every brewery in Munich, I think there were 7, had a big tent, and the place was mad.
There were tables out. You could sit at the tables.
Yes, and then they had these huge kind of barn-like things, and they called them tents.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many thousand people could get in them, but they were just absolutely packed, and the band umped all along, and you umped with them.
And the chunkling?
Yes.
In Münchenstein and Hofbrauhaus, remember that?
Oh, yes, indeed.
And the music was gay and
loud.
Loud. And most people were extremely sociable, were they not?
Yes. Yeah, we had this one group seemed to there, but everybody was so packed, there were so few places to sit or stand.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, we were invited with this group, which was fun because you had more, you felt not quite so much as an outsider.
One thing about the Germans, though, when they go out to have fun, they associate with all different kinds of people. Quite different from in America.
I was quite
surprised to have Dr. Fogel tell me that when you went out to have a good time, that you were very rude if you didn't dance with anyone who asked you to dance. And in business, there was a great deal of class distinction.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I understand at that period of time that you couldn't have a car better than your boss, and you were definitely in a caste system, but socially, definitely not.
The two big things I noticed when that was true was the Oktoberfest and then Fasching, when all the barriers were down. And you would go with a husband or a date or something, you know, whatever. And it was understood that you would not stay with those people necessarily, that you would go with anyone who came up and asked you to dance, which is very different from
mm-hmm.
our social customs.
What is Fasching?
Well, it's a big celebration before Lent. And in Munich, it starts in December when they pick the prince and the princess to preside over the period. And then it's party, party, party until the end of.
Is it costume?
Yes, there are all kinds of costume parties. And little, it was fun to see all the little kids because they were always in Western, cowboys, Indians, and this kind of thing. That was the prevalent one, favorite. And we had, we went to a number of parties, and you could rent costumes or you could concoct your own. And I remember going on a date with somebody to one of the hotels in Munich, and somebody came up and asked me, and he said goodbye and sort of left me, and he said, "I'll see you in such and such a spot at 3 o'clock or whatever the time of the party was to break up. And so I went with this young man whom I had never seen before, and we went in and we went to about 3 of the areas where they danced and had different types of music, whichever one you wanted you could do, drank champagne. And at the time he brought me back and My date dropped his date again, and we went home. So, and but it is, it's everybody joins in, and it didn't matter. Your social
position
really and truly did not count. And you just went, and somebody was attracted to you, and you could not. You could not refuse because it was considered a sort of an insult. And that was true whether you were married or not. And so I guess anything could happen. It's said that very many babies resulted 9 months after the flashing season and that sort of thing. But it was lots and lots of fun. And I have this terrific parade. It's I have scads of slides of the parade. One of the Germans invited me to go where there was a building and the parade. It was a narrow area. It would come through a narrow street and so on. It would be a second floor. So I had an unobstructed view of the parade, and I just took scads of pictures as I leaned out the window. And of course it's there are all kinds of things. Some of them are satirical. Some of them poked fun at the political. One of them I remember poked fun at the Americans for chlorating the water when that was spoiling the beer. And, you know, things of that sort. So it was a long parade. It's about two and a half hours, I guess, as I remember. And everybody was costumed. And then, of course, all of the various sections had their own wagon or their own group, and then they had the different costumes. And women who participate in that cannot cut their hair because they need the braids for this particular thing. So they have keep their hair along. They don't cut it during that period of time. So those were two interesting and I think rather insightful things in the group of people.
Jesse, when you went to Munich, where did you live, and tell us about the school you taught in.
Well, the concern was BOQs, and they were like a series of row apartments, such as they have in Europe, and we were on the second floor, and they had...
Did you have an apartment?
Yes.
How many people in the apartment?
Two. And then we had, we usually ate over at the officers' mess in the club that was at the concern. And
did you pay for your meals?
Yeah, we had just, they were nominal cost, but we had pretty good meals. Mm-hmm. And we had, we got almost all three, because we didn't cook, we didn't have facilities in that particular apartment. So we didn't have the facility to cook, so, and besides, we didn't have commissary privileges. So it meant either buying on the German market, which we got the microwave to, you know, sterilize the vegetables if we bought anything like fresh fruit, and the little bit that the PX had, but that was practically none. And then our friends sometimes got things from the concern from the commissary for us, so that.
You said you had an apartment, but no kitchen?
Well, there was a kitchen there, but it was not equipped with stoves. They had been, as I understand it, they had been SS troops, mm-hmm. where there were officers and families at one time during the Reich period.
There was a living room, bedroom in the apartment?
Yeah, there were two couple beds there, and there was a kitchen.
Bathroom.
Mm-hmm. So it was a complete apartment, except that we just didn't have a stove and that sort of thing to cook. Later on, I moved, and we did have a stove then. Mm-hmm. So I did do some cooking, but most of the time we just stayed at the... It was right across the street, so it was simple. Mm-hmm. We were forced to move out of that apartment because the order had come to integrate the various groups. And the colored WAC detachment was outside the concern. So our building was next to the WAC detachment. And so we were forced to move because they were going to do some intermixing of the two groups. And we were to make way for those WACs that were being transferred into the concern. So, and when I first came there, we were outside the gates because the State Department was there. And because of the trying to work with the Germans, the military and the State Department were at odds. So finally, the State Department moved downtown so they wouldn't be impeded. So I went to school one morning, living outside the walls of the concern. And when I came home at night, I lived within the walls of the concern and guarded gates and showing your papers so that you could get in your AGO card and so on, and that sort of thing. So that was a change. And the Germans came in, they cleaned, they did all the cleaning. And I had not thought anything about it in the black marketing business, but I had picked up 3 cartons of cigarettes when it was cigarette ration time. And I was going out that evening, and so I didn't put them away. I left them on a bookcase. And then I went to school in the morning. When I came home at night, they were gone. And I thought, well, that should teach you not to leave things out. But the next morning, the going rate of cigarettes was left in marks on that same spot where I had left the cigarettes. So I could see the black market evidence really for the first time I'd heard it, but it was the first time I had had a personal experience with it. So and it was very easy when I first came because we were outside and the Germans who worked didn't have to pass the scrutiny of the guards coming in, nor did they have to have their satchels checked and that sort of thing.
Roughly, do you remember what the Germans paid on the black market for a carton of cigarettes?
Yeah, it was 18 marks. I don't think I'll ever forget.
18 marks, and at that time that was 4 marks to the dollar, wasn't
right.
it? Which would be $4.25, 50 cents per carton.
Mm-hmm. So I had, it was a sort of strange feeling because I had been sort of resentful at first, and then I could see the humor in the understanding of it was left out on purpose, and I had not intended it to be done. So anyhow, that was it. But and then I found out more about the various things in black marketing, as time went on. I think that probably the black marketing was helpful to the Germans, particularly at the beginning, prior to the time, because food was scarce. And in trading back and forth for things like Crisco in lard, they had been without fat. And I had found
the Germans liked fat too, didn't they?
They usually a good many of their foods are rather in the fat. But I had found that out from relatives in Holland, that during this period, they called it the starvation period in Holland, when that last year when the Germans didn't pull out, and they were still suffering. So there was a lack of fat, some of the essentials that your body needed and craved.
Coffee either, did they?
No, and coffee was a high market priority. And I think there were other foods too that some of the Americans got from the commissary. And as time went on, in 1950 when I went over, things were much, much better. Things were still a little short, but I don't think there was any real hunger at that point.
No starvation.
No. So when things got better, we were not encouraged to eat in German restaurants. They said 2 reasons. In some instances, it might be sanitary because to be sure that you didn't eat some of the fresh things. Because of the honey wagons.
Uh-huh. Did they use honey wagons in
In Bavaria, they
did. In Bavaria?
Mm-hmm.
Is Munich in Bavaria or another? It is in
Bavaria.
Yeah, it is
in the capital.
Oh, it's the capital of Bavaria.
Mm-hmm. And so they, of course, sort of told us that we should be careful with that and that meats and some of these things were rather hard to come by and rather expensive, so we really shouldn't eat too much in the restaurants. But as time went on, that changed again.
Uh-huh.
And you went to the restaurants more and more. And
I would say that in 1953-54, when I was in Austria, there was no problem of eating on the Austrian or German market, as I remember traveling in Germany.
By the time I went home in 53, you could see on the stands. And I used to stop after we were in the other apartment, and I had a stove. Sometimes I would stop at one of the little German areas, little shopping areas, and pick up some vegetables and fruit. And we used the microwave to soak like lettuce or anything of that sort. And I never had any problems there, where I had some others when I was traveling.
Were the Germans warm? Did they have warm clothing and shoes?
Yeah, they had. It was interesting because we sort of laughed at their shoes in the sense that they had the fleece-lined shoes with the heels and sort of fancy, and they were terribly, terribly expensive for them. And that was really a mark of some substance if you could have a pair of shoes like that. And we sort of laughed, and later on we sort of adapted that type of thing ourselves. But
did you ever buy a pair?
No, because I could wear the, my feet are long and narrow.
Oh.
And the German feet just were not that way, and so I never could buy any. The girl in the PX used to say, "We got some narrow shoes then, so I'd buy another pair of shoes." But that was the only way I could buy shoes over there, because I just couldn't get a foot fit. There were shoes available, and there were lovely leather purses, and they were good shoes. And my roommate happened to have a foot that would fit the sizes, so she could buy them, and she did.
Right. In your contact with the Germans, were they antagonistic toward you? Your name is a Dutch name, is it not?
Right, yes. No, I can't say they were antagonistic, but I ran into some feelings at different places of those who had been a Nazi diehard group. And I was teaching summer school in Augsburg, and I'd gone up to visit a friend who was teaching summer school in Gießen, which was a staging area at that time. And we had gone, her helper was a young German boy, young man, and they were trying to hire a lot of the Germans, trying to sort of indoctrinate the democracy bit. And he was hired, and I guess not only democracy, also to keep the get the economy moving. So he came with us to dinner that night at a German restaurant, and there were a lot of Americans, military, there for the reason they had out, and they had just come and were going to be reassigned places. And there was a curfew, and so all of the Americans had to leave. Officers and enlisted men or anyone in uniform, and as civilians we were not under those restrictions. So we didn't have any wish to go. We were just staying there listening to the music, and the minute the Americans left, the Germans came and filled in the tables, which is in Europe, a place at a table is a place, whether it's your party or not. It's, you know, it's a place, so you sit. Or you join a place. So they talked, and I was talking to this one man, and he asked me to dance, and we danced. And then he said, "You know," he said, "I was a Nazi." And I said, "Oh." He said, "Yeah." He said, "I was an important man in this village." And he said, "You know," he said, "if Hitler were to come back again, I would follow him immediately." He wasn't drunk, but he had been drinking, and so I think his tongue might have been a little loose.
He was wagging.
And so
he was arrogant, was he not?
Rather.
German superiority.
A little bit.
Uh-huh.
And I noticed also my roommate was an older woman in Munich, and her husband was working in Bonn, and she was head of a of a school to primarily to educate the illiterates. And she was in charge of that out at Dachau. And her husband was at Bonn. And one of his jobs had been to try through the selection process to find teachers and people of that sort who might have an influence when they came back and try to indoctrinate the democracy, or to send them to the States for a while to go to school and do some of these things. And Ruth said, well, she said, you know, she said, Russell said, this one young man that he thought so highly of and wanted to go to the States, said, you know, he said, I believe all of what you say, but he said, I could never teach without my desk on a platform, which was typically true of most of the schools. The German schools I was in, the teacher's desk was on a platform about 6-10 inches higher so that the teacher could overlook. He said, I could not lower myself
to be at the same level
as my students. He had to have that. He would have been lost without it, which I think was quite typical of a lot of the Germans, the feeling that you had a position and you could not lower yourself.
Right.
So they, and some of them would. We had one of the...
Then German teachers were sent to America to pick up ways of democracy and teach in the schools upon their return in Germany?
They were, I don't know that all of them went to the States, but at least they were given some training somewhere. I'm hazy on the details now,
because
it's a long, it's 30 years ago, and I'm sort of hazy on some of these details.
As I understand it from friends I have who were raised in Germany, the students argue a great deal more with the teacher than they do here in America.
Is that recent?
No, this she told me maybe 15, 20 years ago. She was raised in Germany and is approximately in the same age group I am, 60 plus or minus 5. And I noticed that in the Austrian school where I taught, that the children, we were on the second floor. Austrian children were below and above us in the high school. We knew immediately when the teacher left the room, because the children were very active, very noisy.
Mm-hmm.
They were well behaved when the teacher was there, mm-hmm. but they did not have the control when the teacher left that we American mm-hmm. teachers have.
Yeah, there is a difference too. One of our German teachers, because they came in and they worked and they were to teach German, and they did some other things too, but the one teacher, when I walked home, sometimes would be either walking or had been near in this little neighborhood area, and any of the children that knew her or had had her in school at one time or had some connection with her would come and shake hands and curtsy on the street, which, you know, I couldn't quite imagine most of our children curtsying to a teacher, but they did, and they were very prim and proper, but evidently thought a great deal of her because they were very eager to run up to her. So she must have had something that was not too austere about her.
Would this have been true for any German teacher, or do you think just this one teacher?
I don't know. That was my only experience with it, so I don't know whether that was general. I would say the curtsy and the shaking hands, of course. Shaking hands was very common when you met people, and I was not unaccustomed to that because I have that with my relatives in Holland. I mean, you come in the house, you shake hands, and you leave, you shake hands.
I like that habit.
It's not a bad habit, I think. I think it's a nice thing, and they did this too, but it was strange. I think a lot of the Germans...
They respect... education, I believe, more than we do.
Yeah, it has a higher standard in their minds. Now, whether that's true at the present, of course, we don't know either. But I think the old traditional, and it was still evident in a lot of things.
And what was the school like where you taught, Jesse?
Well, the school where I first taught was the German school, and it was two stories, and it was sort of an H, you know, without the extra extension of the wings, and some of the upper grades when I was there were on one side, and then the lower grades were on another section. And the first room I had was next door to one of the German rooms. And then later on, I was moved to the other side when they built a new building. And then the high school in the first grade was over at this new building. I guess first and second was over at the new building, and the middle grades and so-called junior high were still in the old building.
Was the high school some distance from you, a mile or a few blocks?
No, it was just walking across the courtyard.
I see.
I understand there is a brand new building over in another section now, not too far from there, but it's still not. The other building was turned over.
Uh-huh.
Central section was like a gym, which was used as sort of an auditorium and a gym. And so the children had that. There was a huge playground. And our kids were always unhappy because the German children were out earlier, but then they went out and did all of their sports activities. Were not sponsored by the school. They were sort of separate from the school, and they always had loads of homework to take home.
The German children did, compared to ours.
Yes.
What grades did you teach?
I had fourth grade 1 year and fifth grade 2 years. And I went into a couple of times. I went into some of the German classrooms for one reason or another. And if I entered as a stranger or a guest, the children immediately stood by their desks until the teacher signaled they could sit. And one time I was in there talking to the teacher, and she had said the children could sit, and the priest came in, and immediately they were all standing again and stood perfectly quiet next to their chairs until they were given permission to sit down. And again, the teacher was on a platform, teacher's desk was a platform, probably about that high. So it was quite different.
Jesse, you said something about military trains. Tell us about it.
Well, they had the sealed trains going into Vienna and into Berlin, and they had the checkpoints that you had to go through. And it was going through the Russian zone because of the country's partition. And you had to go through the Russians in order to get either into Berlin from any of the areas. Now, you could go by flying, but that wasn't always possible. So if you wanted to go to Berlin, you usually went by train, but it was a long way because you had to go, I can't think of the checkpoint, and then you had to go down into Frankfurt and then back into Munich. So one Thanksgiving we flew into Berlin, and the weather got bad, and we were a little delayed because they were taking it was a Berlin airlift period of time, and they had a number of refugees. And they were trying to fly them out, and we were overloaded with baby buggies and one thing or another. And as we went up, they decided they couldn't maneuver well enough to get past the Russian area by flying the particular flyway they were supposed to. And so they turned around and came back. And so we were grounded. We were going back on Sunday afternoon, and we were grounded. So then we tried to get out on the military train, but that was booked solid for a Sunday night, and so we couldn't go out until Monday night. And the trains, of course, both into Berlin and into Vienna, you got on, there was military personnel, MPs, and you had to keep your windows down once you got into the Russian zone, keep your curtains down, and not look out until you got through this particular zone. But the in Vienna was the same way, and you were limited in the area, some of the areas where you could go. Now, as a civilian, you had more freedom than the military people did because they were much more strict with them. But one weekend, we'd gone down to Vienna, and a bunch had met at one of the Hungarian places for dinner. And one of the women in our group was studying for opera. She was an American teacher, but she had decided she wanted to study, so the one way she could do it was to take a house mother for the high school. And then she had time off on her weekends and on her daytimes to take her lessons. So anyhow, we were encouraging her to sing, and we were in sort of a little separate alcove, and we got started, and she was singing some popular songs, and her voice carried, and pretty soon we had everybody in the place applauding, and all the kitchen staff came out and stood around and listened to us, or to her, because we sang once in a while, but she was really the star. And so we spread some goodwill that night. They were pleased. But going back on the train, a Sunday night, a bunch were sitting together and chatting, didn't realize when we pulled out of the station that we had gone into the Russian zone. And the MPs came by and demanded we pull the curtains and keep them pulled until we got out of the Russian zone. And I can always remember the changing of the guard in Berlin when, you know, the various nations would take over for a month, in control for a month. And not too far from our hotel was the Russians, and they had warned us not to take any pictures of the guards and so on. And some girls did, and there was, happened to be that weekend, there were three of us, and we were walking in to our hotel, and the guard at the door said, "Are you the ones that they're looking for?" And we said, "What?" And they had gone over and walked up close to the guards and taken pictures of them in the hotel doorway, and the guards had knocked the cameras and everything down, confiscated, and of course reported it as an incident. So it got tricky sometimes where you could go and where you couldn't.
When I drove to Vienna, we could see the Russian zone. However, we had to check in at a point. As I remember the distance, it was about 100 miles. And if we weren't there in 2-3 hours, they came to look for us. At no time did I stop, but we were not to go to the ladies' room or make any stops of any sort on the way to Vienna.
Yeah, they were incidents of things that had happened to friends, more annoying incidents than anything serious, and they were sort of accustomed to them and just shrugged them off time to time.
Did they take the film out of your camera that day?
They didn't do mine. It wasn't mine. There were three other girls that were involved.
But do you remember, did they take the film out?
I imagine they did, and they confiscated the film because that was customary, and there would be the little diplomatic deal, you know, that somebody invaded the privacy type of thing, and annoyances more than anything else. So,
I think this was common for us to take pictures. I can't remember whether I did or not, but in Vienna I took a tour of the Russian zone.
Well, I went, in Berlin we went out, but it wasn't difficult. And when some of them, I still have pictures in Berlin of the bunker, Hitler's bunker that was blown up before they had destroyed it. Just as it had been left and with some of the grass. And we went through that area and had no difficulty. And I know that night we had tickets for the opera. And so we got a cab and we asked for the opera. And he said, "Do you want to go to East Berlin and West Berlin?" And we said, "Well, our tickets are for West Berlin." He says, "They have better opera in East Berlin. You should go there." Well, under circumstances, we weren't about to, but there wasn't the difficulty of, getting back and forth. You could still
You could do it, but you had to check and have your papers verified. And we did take a military bus across because they were offering tours, and so we had taken that tour, and we weren't stopped or anything. We did get off and take pictures.
Was there a great deal of rubble in Berlin?
Yeah, especially in the eastern sector.
In the eastern sector. Did Berlin seem more austere to you than Munich?
Yes, very much so. Yeah. I think there was a tenseness. Of course, that was that period of the Korean War when I was there, and the flyway, you know, where you could have the three paths coming in and out, and they had the airlift into Berlin. That had all, in that period, it was a little tricky. And the refugees could not go out by train, because if they went out by German train, they would be picked up. And they couldn't, they didn't have, for some reason, I guess, I don't know, couldn't ride the military train. And so they flew them out, so they would not have to go through the Russian sector.
Now, my German friends are from, Dr. Fogel is from Berlin, and they got out of there, he and his mother. He said there were ways for them to escape.
Well, there probably were, but at that time, there wasn't, the Germans could go back and forth between East and West Berlin. There was no problem.
Oh, I see.
Not like it is now, but right. I suppose they had to have papers to show. But they would always, a lot of the GIs would fall asleep on the train or the streetcar type of thing, you know. And sometimes they would wake up and they'd be in there. Well, then there would be this little incident, and they, right. I guess this happened regularly. There was, nobody seemed to be too excited about it.
Mm-hmm. I never did I get into the Russian zone by streetcar in Vienna. We were just across the street, I mean, across the Danube mm-hmm. from the Russian zone. But it would be very easy to go across there on the streetcar.
We did. We went over and we took the Ferris wheel ride. And the third man was the movie that was popular. And we mm-hmm. saw the place where that had been filmed and gone to some of the places. And we also decided we'd go into Prater, which is a kind of an amusement park area. And we rode the Ferris wheel, which is prominent in the film,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing. But we were glad to get out.
I
think it was fairly comfortable to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And not that, as civilians, we were, I think, there wasn't much point for the Russians to fuss at civilians. You know, it was would have been more mm-hmm. meaningful to fuss at somebody who's in military.
And yet it could have been an incident where the American consulate would have had to
right,
get you if the Russians held you, and they could hold you.
Yeah, we were, but you know, you didn't think quite that much about it as a civilian.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot more leeway. But anyhow, I'll always remember, even in Vienna back then, the pastries.
They were rich.
Oh, they were marvelous. And I don't think anyone who ever goes. And seemingly, everybody, and I noticed that in Germany, too, everything in the afternoon, it didn't matter how much it cost, people would stop and have coffee and something with schlock in the afternoon and get a pastry. And they were terribly expensive. It would be the equivalent of $5 almost, because I can remember some of the pastries being marked about, in Germany, being marked about $4 for a mark 75, and your coffee was always expensive. And so with a tip, that would be rather an expensive refreshment.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Germans weren't making that much, actually.
Do you remember what your salary was then, and what a German would be making?
I can't remember. I tried to look it up. What I was getting, and I couldn't find it, and I have no idea. I would say, you know, that was a standard.
Around 4,000 or 5,000, wasn't it, a year?
I don't think it was that much when I went over in 50. I think probably it was closer to less than 3,000 when I went over.
But you did have your room free, and you paid
yes.
for your...
our meals were our own, but we did have...
You had the advantage of going to the hotels, didn't you? And
yes.
For about $2 a night.
Yeah, or a dollar. I mean, going down to Garmisch for skiing or something,
mm-hmm.
It would be a weekend you could get by at any of the better places for, with meals and everything, about $10 for the weekend.
Right.
Because you could look 75 cents, I think, for the RTOs, which was the military railroad ticket. You got that at the, you know, the military depot park.
Mm-hmm.
And but it was an inexpensive, it was a way of getting a beautiful recreation. Ski lessons were 25 cents, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And
that would be 1 mark back in that time.
Yeah, it would be about a mark.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nice. But anyhow, the things that I remember, my first Christmas that I was there, I did go to Egypt, and the trip included Jerusalem, which was really what I wanted to do. And the old part of Jerusalem, which was in Jordan at that time. And when we got, when we flew from Egypt into Jordan, we had to go way south and back because we could not cross the Israeli territories because of the war situation, or sort of what had stopped at that point, but it was still very evident. And the older part of Jordan had tank traps still. When you went around some places, you had to watch that. And they had the barbed wire dividing the new city from the old city. And so since most of us in the group were more interested in the old city, the historic and the part, and we couldn't go back and forth between the two countries when that choice was made, we took the trip that would include the old part. And I think I got just a bit of the feeling that was evidenced recently in some of the problems, and why there has been some real serious problems since that time. The feeling from the Palestinians, and I was invited to a Palestinian home of some people who were refugees, and of course they were quite bitter. And they had hopes of going back, and were resentful. They had been quite well off, and now we're not too well off, though we were in this home. We lived out in the countryside, and we went in, and couldn't see. It was so dark. And we came in, and they were being polite. We were in this room, which would be a living room, and there was no heat, and I was freezing. I was so cold. And finally they said, after we'd gone through some formalities and one thing or another, would you like to come into where it's warmer, into the kitchen? And I was so grateful. And we had a lovely evening. I enjoyed it very much. But I think it gave me some understanding of some of the bitterness that some of the groups have, and why it's so difficult to even talk a peace and try a peace, because of all the little bit that I got that evening and the little bit of the few days that I was there that I saw and heard, you could understand why there's going to be a great deal of difficulty in ever even thinking that there's going to be a lasting peace there. So, let's see. I guess that's about all.
Well, thank you, Jessie. But Jessie, you didn't tell us why you came home. You were there 3 years.
Yes. Well, I had come to the point, at 3 years, you have to make a decision. You're either going to have to stay with the idea of making that work a career, or coming home and picking up things, because it would be too long to be gone much. I mean, you just would have to, you'd lose your ties at home for career possibilities. And I was needed at home. My father had become ill. And weighing things out, I decided my wisest choice would be to come home and reestablish myself here and do what I could at my home.
Did you come home each summer?
No, I taught summer school the first year. And so then the third year, of course, I traveled until I did come home.
I see. Well, you stayed two summers in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd been away a total of 3 years before you came mm-hmm. back?
Yeah,
that was a long time.
I had 3 teaching years.
Mm-hmm. Were you lonesome for the United States?
No, I don't think so.
I was terribly lonesome for it.
I miss certain things, of course, but I've been very fortunate, maybe, that when I'm with some place or something that's finished or done with, or I've made a decision, then that's it, and it doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't get nostalgic about, well, whether I should have or I shouldn't have. And I miss my parents. That was my first Christmas away from home. I'd always managed to get home if only for 24 hours. And I couldn't do it very well. And I think the last Christmas I was there, we went skiing in Switzerland. We went for a week. And in the...
That's on Ritz, perchance? Oh, I was there too.
No, it was at Coasters.
Oh.
I wasn't there too, so no, it was at the Coasters, but there was a hotel that name. And it was on the Swiss plan, which was one of those helping the Swiss get back on their feet as far as hotel business was concerned. And so it was a very inexpensive way to do this at a very lovely hotel. And so we had the week there. And Christmas Eve, we had dinner, and the dining room was off sort of a mezzanine, and as we came out, they had placed about a 2-story tree in the center of the lobby, which came up over the mezzanine part, and you still had to look up, and it was lit with candles. But I was homesick. That was the first time I could really and truly say in the years that I was gone that I was homesick. I had always been able to be busy at that time, but that was the last straw. So I don't think I've ever seen a more beautiful tree except some that my grandmother had with candles. But here was it was dark, and then all this huge tree that was just loaded with candles.
People came in and lit them by hand.
Well, they had fixed them, you know, so mm-hmm. they reached. But it was lovely, and so, but I think that's it.
And you're back in Lansing, and you went back to your old school?
Went back to the same town, but into a brand new school that had been just built while I had been gone.
Did you teach in East Lansing before you left?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you came back to East Lansing?
I came back to East Lansing.
Mm-hmm. You were originally from Grand Rapids, weren't you?
Right, I was born in Grand Rapids.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, too, so.